Some stuff that Laurent and George Minich and I have been working on for many years now, although, what did I do with the chop? There it is. Although I think it's finally starting to crystallize a little bit what we had in mind all along. So one of our sort of original motivations was to study duality symmetric formulations of string theory. Okay, so you know, some formulation that would be covariant with respect to some of the most important stringy symmetries, such as T-duality. And I'll remind you, or tell you, what's meant by that as we go along. I'm just going to keep this talk at a very low level, because the result is really very simple, and it's a little bit surprising. So it's important that I think it's important that I at least give the impression that I'm not waving my hands around and fooling you. Okay, so I'm going to go back to basically Polchinski's book on string theory and ask some questions about some of the formulation. And I'm going to suggest that there's something that was missed all along, which involves a certain non-commutativity. But this non-commutativity appears in a rather surprising place. So this is something, this is a subject that we've known about for many years. Non-commutativity in the field theory sense comes up in a variety of ways in string theory. But it always had to do with turning on some sort of background for the string that sort of acted as a source for the non-commutativity. Okay, and part of that story always involved, it seems, open strings. Okay, so in open strings with non-trivial backgrounds. And here, what I'm going to show you is that there's a non-commutativity in string theory in the closed string sector itself. Okay, so as I said, the strength of the non-commutativity is set by the value, if you like, of the background. Okay, and here the non-commutativity is going to be associated with closed strings. Even in the most trivial backgrounds, okay, and in fact that's the only example I'm going to talk about today. But the strength of the non-commutativity, it turns out, is set by the string scale itself. So I'm going to typically call the string length lambda, okay, that has units of length in the target space. So that's, if you like, that's L string. Okay, so that's the result that I'm going to try to work towards. And just as a sort of introduction, let me remind you that what we think of as a space-time coordinate in string theory plays sort of a dual role. Okay, let me call that generically X. I'll put that in quotes for reasons that we'll see as we go along. It plays a dual role in the sense that, from the world sheet point of view, it's a field. Okay, it describes the embedding of the string in a target space. And from the other point of view, from the sort of space-time point of view, we think of it in an effective field theory sort of way as an index on fields. Okay, so we have some set of fields that are labeled by that concept. And it's sort of traditional in string theory to sort of equate these notions, in particular to think of the geometry that of the embedding here as shared by this field theory description. And that's typically very well founded. It was sort of one of the original assumptions, you know, going back many, many years, where people began thinking about string theory as an S matrix theory in Minkowski space. Okay. So this is okay generally. That sort of identification is fine generally in non-compact spacetimes, as far as we know. Okay, whereas the non-commutativity that I'm gonna tell you about occurs in the case where we consider compact spacetimes. Okay, and just as a sort of outline, what I'm gonna do is I'm going to show you this effect from a variety of points of view. And the simplest, or at least the conceptually simplest way to think about this is to just go back to the formulation of the string and consider the symplectic structure of the theory. Okay, and this is going to be in the compact case, as I said. And as I also said to begin, we're just going to consider the simplest possible thing, this compactification on tori with no non-trivial backgrounds turned on. Okay. This symplectic structure calculation, of course, is what encodes the canonical Poisson brackets in the classical theory. And it tells you how to quantize the theory. It tells you what the canonical equal time commutation relations are. Okay, so as a first pass, what I'm gonna do is I'm just going to do that calculation carefully. And as we'll see, there's a surprise in that calculation, which I think is actually fundamental to the theory. Okay, and then following that, I'll give you, to finish up, I'll go through a number of consequences of the result and different ways to think about it. Okay, so just to get into this a bit, so in the classical theory, when I say I'm gonna consider the symplectic structure, there's a procedure which hopefully by now is fairly familiar. The idea is that, and so I'm gonna start by working classically. Okay, the procedure is that one, assuming you have an action, you vary it. Okay, and you think about that variation on the space of solutions of the classical equations of motion. And you can deduce from that calculation the so-called presymplectic one form. Okay, in a I'll give you a little bit more details about that in a moment. So this is the thing that I'm going to construct and interpret. And on the other hand, I'll discuss a bit later on the quantum side of things. On the quantum side of things, I'm going to relate this to various principles that we all hold dear, such as causality on the world sheet. And locality. Okay, so let's start. Let me first set up some notation, just so that we're all on the same page. I'm just going to do the simplest possible sort of compactification. In fact, the notation I'm going to use is as if I was doing a one-dimensional torus or a circle. Okay, and when one writes string theory on such a space, one finds that you have to include for consistency some twisted states that we call winding modes. Okay, the basic, one way to say what this means is that you have to relax the boundary conditions on the closed strings to allow windings. Okay, so we'll write that. If you go around the string, these winding modes are such that you don't come back to the same place in the covering space of this compactification, but you're shifted by a multiple of 2 pi r, okay? So that w is an integer. Okay, and if you look at the theory classically, of course, what you find is of course the classical solution is just the sum of a left and right moving solution. Okay, and you can write down the explicit solutions. These are the familiar mode expansions. Okay, again, I'm just doing this to set notation. Okay, and let me I'm not going to talk much about oscillators, so I'll just write it that way. And then x right similarly looks like this. Okay, and these quantities that appear in the mode expansion, when we quantize, they should become operators, right? And their commutation relations are what I'm sort of focusing on here. I'm going to derive what those commutation relations are. And these things have a physical interpretation in terms of the target space, because if I form the sum of these two things, you can see that this, this becomes, I'm going to write this like x plus alpha prime p tau okay, where x here is x left plus x right, and p is p left plus p right over 2. Okay, and I've introduced another quantity here. You can see that when I take the sum, I get the difference of p right and p left. Okay, now t-duality. Well, there's various ways to say how t-duality operates. But at this level, one way that you can say what t-duality does is that it operates almost trivially on these modes, except that it switches the sign of x left and p left. Okay, at the level of the full functions, it takes x right to x right and x left to minus x left. Okay, and because of that, so we'll talk more about that in a moment, but because of that, it's natural to introduce another function, which we call x tilde, which is just the difference of the two. Okay, and if you look at the expansions, you can see that there's a relationship at the level of currents. The time derivative of x, which in the Polyakov theory is the momentum conjugate to x, the momentum field, is actually given by a sigma derivative of x tilde. Okay, and if you similarly write out x tilde here, what you find is that, where x tilde is x right minus x left. Okay, and you can see that the relationship between this and this is very simple. It just looks like I'm interchanging x and x tilde and p tilde. Okay, and there's a similar statement about the oscillators. Okay, well, usually this, you know, it's the field x that we talk about, because we have an interpretation of that in terms of the target space. Okay, and x tilde seems to be just some auxiliary quantity. But in fact, they really play a similar role in the string theory because again, of t-duality. So another take on t-duality is that, and another important feature of t-duality, of string theory, is that you never really get dimensional reduction. Okay, so for example, in this case, if I took the radius of compactification to zero, you don't get a one less dimensional theory. And the reason is that these winding modes are present. Okay, so let me write down what the spectrum of the theory is. Okay, which you can think of as a set of constraints that come from world sheet symmetries. Okay, they look like this. Okay, this quantity here is what I'm calling P. This quantity is what I'm calling P tilde. And then there's some stuff from oscillators. Two, I guess. Okay, and I've introduced a new quantity here, which is R tilde. Sorry, there's another constraint that I'll write in a second. But R tilde is often called the dual radius. It's inversely proportional to R, so it satisfies a relation like that. Okay. So it goes like 1 over R in string units. Okay, and the other constraint is what usually is called the level matching constraint, which in this language is NW, is I think N left minus N right. Okay, and this mass squared here, I'm just assuming that maybe there are some non-compact directions, and that's the invariant momentum squared in those non-compact directions.
So you need to divide by R of T.
I didn't, yeah.
When is an integer?
So you said that lambda is the degree of a non-commutative?
Yeah, we're going to get, that's where we're going to get. But
okay.
Yeah, we haven't gotten there yet. I'm just discussing.
So lambda equals 0 would be commutative, or lambda equals, I'm just thinking of the limits.
Yes, that's what will happen, but let's leave it finite for the. Okay, so I'm leaving all the radii finite and the string length finite, and okay, so one aspect of t-duality, one way to think about it, is that it's a symmetry of this spectrum of these constraints under a swap of n, say, with the, well, okay, so let me write it this way. It's a swap of the momentum and winding with just a swap of those along with the radii. Pardon? Okay. Okay, you can see that these both. Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Or if you like, it's a swap of P with P tilde. Okay, and this is where you can now see that if you take limits, one of the familiar arguments is that if you take the limit, what I was mentioning a moment ago, well, if I take R to infinity, okay, what happens? Well, you know, this is a very large, for any finite W, that's a very large distance, and in the limit that R goes to infinity, R tilde goes to zero. Okay, so a mode with non-zero W is very massive from the non-compact point of view. Okay, so the winding modes are just driven to zero, and then the momentum modes becomes continuous, and this is the way that you get a non-compact direction. But the same thing happens if you take R to zero, right? What happens there is that N is forced to zero, okay, for the same reason, and W becomes continuous. Okay, so this dual, if you like, you can sort of think of this as, you can think of this as a dual momentum. It's the one that's becoming continuous. And in this case, the non-compact coordinate is x. And in fact, what happens is x tilde is there, but it decouples from everything. And the opposite is true in this other limit. Okay, so x tilde looks like the space coordinate. And x actually decouples. Okay, so this is why I said it's traditional to think about x as the thing that the string couples to, but because of this t-duality symmetry of the closed string, the zero modes, x and x tilde, are very much on the same footing. Okay, how you interpret the physics depends upon what limit you're in.
If you say x tilde decouples, you mean it doesn't appear in the target space action?
Well, I just mean here that because this quantum number n is going to zero, every finite energy state has zero momentum, and the conjugate variable to that is x. Okay, so in other words, all the states are independent of x because the momentum is zero. Okay, well, so this is what happens in a limit, but this symmetry is present, you know, generally, right? For arbitrary radius, you just have to be careful about how you define the symmetry operation. Okay, and you can ask, well, so notice, remember, I guess I didn't tell you this, but the theory that we're going to consider is just the Polyakov action. So classically, I just need the action. And that's just 1 over 4 pi alpha prime dx wedge star dx. The action just knows about, it doesn't know about x itself, it knows about dx. Okay, and so it's fair to ask, how does the theory know? Well, the x's are, you know, these x and x tilde are constants on the world sheet. So it's fair to ask, how does the theory actually know about those? Okay, and what we're going to see is that the answer to that is that the theory knows about them in sort of a topological sense. Okay, so I'll explain that as we go along. Okay, so let me come back to this calculation of the symplectic structure. Okay, as I said, all we need to do is to just take this action and vary it. Okay, and in field theory, when you do such a calculation, typically what you have in mind is that you think about foliating the space-time. So here's a picture of space-time. Okay, here are some space-like hypersurfaces. And normally what happens is that when you construct this symplectic form, it's written as an integral over a constant time slice or a space-like hypersurface. Okay? And that's generally true as long as there are no boundaries. Okay, if there are no boundaries in space-time. In the present context, we're going to have to manage the boundaries carefully. So why do I say that? Well, I'm applying this to the closed string. Okay, so if I draw a picture of the world sheet space-time, the simplest thing to consider is a cylinder. And the way that I'm going to deal with this is I'm going to cut it open. Okay, so you can think about this as world sheet time and sigma going around. What I'm going to do is I'm going to slice this open along some seam and unfold it. Okay, so this looks like this. Okay, and you can think about one edge here as corresponding to, say, sigma equals 0, and the other edge to sigma equals 2 pi, and the cylinder is just obtained by identifying these two things. But in the presence of a compactification, it's very important that the fields, in fact, are not single value when you do this identification, right? Precisely because of the winding. Okay, if you, for example, it's still up there at the top, okay, the embeddings are not single value. And because of that, what we're going to find is that there are contributions to the symplectic flux, to the symplectic structure, that come from the edges of this diagram. Okay. And so many of you may have heard about, I mean, this is sort of similar in spirit to several things that have been happening in the literature in the last few years. One example of a sort of similar thing is, well, that's been known for decades, is that if I take a Chern-Simons theory in three dimensions, right, in that case what happens is there are no there aren't really any bulk degrees of freedom, but if I put the theory on a space-time with a boundary, you find that there are degrees of freedom localized on the boundary. Okay, and this is typically gives you Wessamino-Witten theories. Okay, another example that Laurent and William Donnelly studied was the sort of corresponding case of Yang-Mills or gravity in four dimensions, and they argued. They were sort of focused on entanglement in that case, but they argued that in order to preserve the symmetries of the system when you do these calculations, you find that in fact there are edge modes that are dynamical. And then another example is the BMS stuff that Strominger and other people have been looking at recently. Again, there are sort of surprising modes. In that case, they're off at infinity in Minkowski space, okay? So that's sort of the spirit of what's going on here. We're gonna find that there are degrees of freedom on the edge of the world sheet whenever we have a compactification, okay? That's the first result, okay? And what that's going to do is effectively just make x left, p left, x right, and p right independently dynamical, okay? So that's good, but in addition to that, there's going to be a surprise. The symplectic form isn't quite what you might have expected. Okay, so I need to show you that calculation. Okay, so if we write out the Polyakov action, which has disappeared, in just standard coordinates. Okay, it looks like that, of course. And if you vary it, there are various contributions. Okay, typically what you find when you do such a calculation is you find that, well, you find something like this. You find a term integrated over the entire world sheet, which is proportional to the equations of motion. Okay, so if I'm going to go on shell and set that to zero, okay, but typically in order to get this term, you have to integrate by parts a number of times in general. Okay, and so in addition to that, there are some total derivative terms, okay, and it's those terms that determine the symplectic structure. Okay, or if you like, they determine the boundary conditions. Okay, and so let's just look at what they look like in this case. Okay, well, if I have a total derivative, what I get is an integral over the boundary. And as I said, in the present case, I should really think about the whole thing here as part of the boundary. And indeed, if you like, there's a total sigma derivative as well as a total tau derivative. Am I going to have enough room? Let me pull this down. Okay, so when you vary the action, okay, first of all, you get a total tau derivative. Okay, so it's the difference of two terms evaluated at the beginning and end times. And this is the standard term. This is just the term that tells you that d tau x is the momentum conjugate to x, if you like. And you can, you can read this as p delta x. Okay, and this being integrated over sigma, this is integrated over a constant tau slice, either tau 0 or tau 1. Okay, so that's the usual contribution. And then the total sigma derivative looks like this. Okay, again, I just integrated by parts in the sigma direction and wrote it as an integral along tau. Okay, the two contributions correspond to an integral to integrating tau along this edge or this edge. Okay, but this now is not zero in general. The reason is that the field is not single valued, right? Because of the winding number, x and perhaps delta x takes a different value on the two boundaries. So let me write this as that. Okay, so so x is not single valued, right, because of this winding, but this is a constant. So the currents, the derivatives of x are single valued. Okay, so I used that here to write this like that. Okay, so the question is, well, what do we do with this? What do we do with this expression? It's not written, as I said, in the usual way as an integration over a space-like hypersurface. Well, what you can do to analyze this is you can make use of this relation that I wrote here. Okay, so that's just a that is a definition, or that's just something that by hand X tilde satisfies. But on shell, the equation of motion looked like that. So on shell, it's also true that d sigma x is d tau x tilde. Okay, and so I can make use of that on shell to replace this by d tau x tilde. And then it turns out that this quantity here is, with the 2 pi, is just delta p tilde. Okay, I guess you can, if you look at the mode expansions, you can deduce that easily enough. And this is time independent. It can be pulled outside the integral. And then the integral over tau can be done. Okay, so what it gives you, here somewhere, is a term like that. Okay, so we often refer to this as a corner term. Okay, it's something that is that's localized on the boundary of the world sheet, right? It's not like this usual term. It's not written as an integral over a space like hypersurface, but it's just a single unintegrated quantity. Okay, so at the end of the day, you deduce from this that the symplectic one form, the presymplectic one form, okay, has this corner term plus the usual integral. Okay, and that's defined at along a particular value of tau. Okay, so that's actually the result. The result is that there's this extra contribution, and I'm going to process this a little bit to show you what it means. Okay, but it turns out that there's several ways to think about why that had to occur. One reason is that if I go back to this original construction, I made choices here, right? First of all, I chose coordinates on the cylinder. But even in those coordinates, I made a choice of where I cut the cylinder open, right, to get this picture. Okay, and as you know, I mean, diffeomorphisms on the world sheet are a gauge symmetry in string theory, and so presumably anything that's physical should be diff invariant. Okay, and one of the things that you can show is that you need this term. So if I, you know, if you imagine cutting it somewhere else and redoing the calculation, okay, it turns out that in order for this to be invariant under where you cut the surface open, you need that term. It sort of repairs the problem. Okay, if you like, it restores the diffeomorphism symmetry on the world sheet. Okay, so that's one way to see that it's really required. Okay, another thing that we can do to process this a little bit is, well, this is of course an on-shell calculation, so what you can do is you can insert the solutions, the mode expansions, into this expression and proceed and try to interpret that. Okay, so actually what I will write is the symplectic two form. I'm going to call that omega, and that's just the functional variation of theta. Okay, so if you think about this as a one form on the space of fields, this is a two form, okay, and it's this object that determines the Poisson brackets. Okay, and as I said, I'm going to insert the mode expansions here, and here's what you get. Okay, so far so good. Okay, so there are oscillator terms here. Okay, and if this was the answer, what this would say is that X and P are conjugate, canonically conjugate, and X tilde and P tilde are canonically conjugate. Okay, and if you work through these definitions, that would mean that X left and P left are canonically conjugate, and X right and P right are canonically conjugate. Okay, and so I'm not done writing the formula yet, but so one of the things we see here is that, well, this term came from here, largely. Okay, and so that corner term was in fact responsible for making these modes independently dynamical. Okay. As I said, this isn't the total answer. There's a shift here that looks like that. Okay, so as I've said several times, you know, this symplectic structure determines the commutation relations. I'm not going to write the oscillator terms, but they determine the usual commutation relations of the left and right moving oscillators. Okay, and this is the symplectic structure of the zero mode sector. Okay, so a sort of brute force way to analyze what's going on is to collect everything into a vector and write this as a matrix equation. Okay, so I'll use the notation. I'm going to get the order right. Px. I'm just collecting everything into a vector. These are the phase space coordinates, if you like. And I'm going to write omega as in terms of a matrix omega alpha beta, and this omega alpha beta, you can read off, has this form, but this extra term here gives you a piece here. Okay, and when you quantize the theory, or if you do Poisson brackets, okay, what you find is that the commutator is just given by the inverse of this matrix. The matrix is constant, and so you just get, well, there's a traditional IH bar there. Okay, so you have to invert that matrix. Okay, that's easy to do. It just moves things around a little bit. And from this, then, you can read off what the commutation relations of all of these guys are. So the result is the following. Okay, P and P tilde commute. X and P just satisfy a Heisenberg algebra, as do X tilde and P tilde. Okay, and then the extra term here tells you that X and X tilde don't commute. Okay, when you work it out, this is 2 pi I lambda squared delta M. Okay, so this is what I meant when I said that the string length determines the non-commutativity scale. Okay, but now you can see here that when I referred to non-commutativity, I didn't mean from the point of view of the space, which you might think of as coordinatized just by X, but it's a sort of extra non-commutativity within the phase space itself, right? Within the space of both X and X tilde. Okay, so it turns out that as far as we can tell, this calculation was never done carefully, in the past, and there are various places in the literature, people talk about it at all, where they just assumed that this was zero and that these guys were just canonically conjugate. Okay?
Can I ask a question about the last line on the upper board there? It looks like the expression is just symmetric under exchange of P, you know, tilted and untilded things. Why did you group the PP which PP tilted term in?
Oh, no particular reason. Well, what you might have said is that, you know, you could read this to mean that the quantity that's conjugate to P tilde is not X tilde, but it's this linear combination. Okay, so in other words, one way to diagonalize the system would be to change coordinates, not to use these coordinates, but use, instead of X tilde, use the shifted coordinate. Okay, and sort of the point is that, yeah, you could do that. It would be simple to diagonalize the commutation relations. But the point is then that this thing that this coordinate is not the one that appears in the mode expansion of the field. Okay? So it's not the one in particular. Remember, I argued that X tilde is the coordinate when you take R to zero. Right? It's this sort of spatial coordinate when you take R to zero. That guy is not canonically conjugate to P tilde. It actually doesn't commute with X. Okay, so another way to think about this is to ask, well, first of all, why did this happen? And what does it affect? Where does this commutation relation appear? Okay, and it's sort of natural to think about, well, the canonical equal time commutators. Okay. And if you think about various operators in the theory, if you try to find an example of an equal time commutator that actually involves this, the only one, or certainly the simplest one, is a commutator like this, where you take the commutator of x with x tilde. If I can evaluate this, this is a free field theory, so I can evaluate this just by inserting the mode expansions, okay, and you'll find that, well, there's a contribution from X and X tilde, and then there are various other contributions. There's one other contribution from the zero modes. I think I got that right. And then there's contributions from the oscillators. There's sort of an infinite number of plane wave contributions from the oscillators. And these sum up into a distribution. Which I'll call theta. Theta's a staircase function. Okay, and given this result, this guy contributed here, and all of these other modes added up into this staircase distribution. And this satisfies various properties. Okay, so one of the things, well, okay, so all I really need is that it's equal to pi on the open interval between 0 and 2 pi. Okay? And if you shift sigma by 2 pi, it jumps up or down by 2 pi. And it has the property, of course, that if you take its derivative, you get a delta function. Okay? So what is this contribution of xx tilde doing? Well, what it does is it ensures that on this entire interval, this actually evaluates to zero. Okay, it's not minus pi or some other number, it's exactly zero. Why does that have to happen? Well, this is a commutator, it's an equal time commutator. If you're in this regime, sigma 1, 2 is in this regime, It's a commutator at space-like separation. Okay, and so it should vanish by causality. Okay, so from this point of view, that's what this non-zero commutator is doing. It's restoring causality on the world sheet. Okay, another way to think about that is that, you know, you might squawk and say, well, you know, maybe I don't want to think about x tilde at all, and so I don't care about this. But another way to think about this result is that it's an integration of a commutation relation that you do care about, which is x with its conjugate momentum. Okay, this guy is certainly non-zero. It's a delta function. Okay, with a standard number here. Okay, this is the same result given that this is identified with d sigma x tilde. Okay, so if I take this expression and integrate both sides with respect to sigma 2, okay, I'm going to get this on the left-hand side. And from the delta function, I'm going to get a step function. Okay, but there's an integration constant there. And the point is that integration constant isn't arbitrary. It's fixed by causality. It has to be this one. Okay, it has to be that in order that the entire theory is causal. Okay, another place where this shows up is sort of a technical place in string theory. It's actually related to causality. It's a property called mutual locality. So you can think of this mutual locality as essentially the Euclidean version of causality on the world sheet, but what it says basically is that if I have two physical vertex operators, okay, they should be mutually local. So in other words, if I have two vertex operators, and you imagine, I don't know, taking one around the other, okay, that should be a single valued operation. Okay, and this is a, okay, so what you want to do is you want to understand, well, what does that requirement imply about the theory? Okay, and so if you want to see the calculation done carefully, you can look in our paper, or you can look in Polchinski's book up to a certain point. And the simplest version is to just look at a tachyon vertex operator. Okay, so I'll write that as W of KK tilde. Okay, and in string theory, up to some normal ordering, the vertex operator is just a pure exponential of X. Okay, and sorry, I screwed this up already. In the compact case, what you would write is you want to have a vertex operator that has both momentum and winding. Okay, so one way to write that is to introduce an expression like that. Okay, now you can pull this apart into contributions that come from oscillators and contributions that come from zero modes. I'm going to write that like this. I'm not going to worry about too many of the details here, but as I said, you can roughly think of these as the contributions from the oscillators. And when I do this computation of mutual locality, you know, you're going to have to commute these past each other in a certain way, and so that's going to give you some stuff. But this is the, roughly speaking, the zero mode part. Okay, and okay, so one way to parameterize this is to say that, well, first of all, let me introduce a notation. I'm going to collect together k and k tilde into a mod k here. And then one way to parameterize what these guys are is that if you multiply, so I'm going to take the product of two vertex operators, so I'm going to be interested in generally the product of these things at different momenta. Okay, and generally what happens is that, well, this is just the corresponding u for the sum of momenta up to some phase, okay, up to a co-cycle factor, epsilon. Okay, and you can work through and figure out what this mutual locality requirement says about that co-cycle epsilon. And hopefully I wrote it down. Okay, so what you find is that this thing can't be quite symmetric in K and K prime, but the ratio of the object in the different orders is fixed. And I'll just tell you the result. It turns out that it's this. Okay, so it's a phase, okay, that's just determined by the momenta of the vertex operator. Okay, so you can, you know, you can write a solution of this equation if you like. Okay, this is something that effectively Polchinski derives in his book. Okay, there's nothing wrong with that part of the calculation. But if you look at the details, what he says is that, well, okay, how do you make this work? How do we make this work? Well, you can write a representation for that zero mode factor. So this is Polchinski, or anybody else. You can write this like, well, let me write it in terms of the left and right modes. Okay, so that's sort of naively what you would have expected by looking at this expression here. Okay, but maybe you need a fudge factor in order to get this to work out. Okay, and so unfortunately that fudge factor is also often called a co-cycle. It depends on the choice of k and k tilde. And importantly, it's an operator. It's an operator that is assumed to depend on p left and p right. Okay, and so the question is what do I have to take this to be? Okay, so you want to work out what is that operator in order that this mutual locality property be satisfied. Okay, so if you look in Polchinski, what he did at this point is he assumed, sorry, I've erased them, but he just assumed that the left movers and right movers had the standard commutation relations, but that x left and x right commute with each other, or x and x tilde commute with each other. Okay, and then what you find is that this has to be some ugly thing, which I think I wrote down. Okay, it turns out that it's an exponential of p. Okay. On the other hand, if you use these commutation relations, okay, with this being precisely that value, what do you find? You find that this fudge factor can be chosen to be 1. Okay, just the identity operator. Okay, so what does that mean? Well, it means that this operator, this can be taken to be one, this operator is just a very nice vial operator. In other words, it has labels k and k tilde, or k left and k right. Those are just numbers. And its operatorial content is just in the x and x tilde. Okay? Okay, and then this relation here is in fact just a copy of the Heisenberg group. Okay. Okay, but it's a copy of the Heisenberg group, not on the spaces of like an x and a p, right? But on the space of x and x tilde. Okay, how much time do I have? Am I done? I mean, I have lots to say, but I could cut it short. Not that much? Okay. Okay. Okay, so let's see. So what else can I tell you? Okay, so why did I tell you all of this stuff? Well, this is, let me just say a few words about why this is important. Another place where this sort of calculation comes up is in the construction of orbifolds in string theory. Okay? And for certain simple orbifolds, the so-called symmetric orbifolds, whether or not you use something like this or something like this, it's easy to solve the theory and understand these details. One of the things I should have said is that, traditionally, you just sort of learn to live with these, with this result. Okay, and in fact, what happens is that because I'm talking about the compact case, right, the spectrum of this operator on physical states is quantized, right, in units of the radius, as we talked about before. Okay, and as a result, in fact, when you evaluate this thing, it's not a general phase, but it's just a plus or minus one. Okay, so the typical thing that you do in string theory is you just deal with these co-cycle fudge factors, and you learn to fix up the signs sort of at the end of the calculation. Okay, so what this indicates is that, well, in fact, if you do it right, you don't even need a fudge factor. Things are going to work out properly themselves. Okay, as I was saying, in the case of symmetric orbifolds, it's not really a problem. These are understood. But there are other string backgrounds, the so-called asymmetric orbifolds, okay, where the symmetry acts differently on the left and right movers, where it's just a hornet's nest. If you look at the literature, it's all about trying to figure out what a consistent set of these fudge factors are, and it's not, and the spectrum of the theory isn't even understood. The so-called twisted states in general aren't understood. Okay, so one of our, we like to call it one of the killer apps of this, is that from this point of view, I think we're going to be able to understand asymmetric orbifolds completely, okay, including the spectrum. Okay, we haven't written that up yet, but that's one of the expected results. Okay, and it goes beyond that. It goes beyond that to more exotic backgrounds, even more exotic backgrounds as well. Okay, so that's one point. Another point is that one of the effects of this, and I'm not going to be able to explain this in any great detail, but one of the effects of realizing the structure of the commutation relations is that it makes the theory fully covariant under symmetries. T-duality is an example of that. But also, there are more general symmetries that correspond to turning on background fields, like a BMU field. So let me just, and with these commutation relations, you obtain covariance with respect to, generally it's referred to as ODD. Okay, and an example of this corresponds to turning on a constant B field. And when I say it has covariance with respect to this, what I mean is that you don't have to work hard to figure out what the effect of turning on a background like this is. It's just it's effectively just a rotation in the space of x and x tilde. Okay? So for example, so in this case, what you find, okay, so if you like, one way to study this is you can just repeat the calculation that I referred to in the presence of a constant B field. That changes things. It changes some of the details. A constant B field doesn't actually affect the bulk equations of motion on the world sheet. It just changes the boundary conditions. You get a so-called Neurine lattice. Okay, but when you do this symplectic calculation, what you find is that the commutation relations amongst the x and x tilde are deformed. Okay, this is the one that we had before. And the B field shows up in a non-zero commutator of x tilde with itself. I think it's this. Okay. And in fact, this is one way to think about the sort of more standard appearance of non-commutative geometry in string theory. Sort of roughly speaking, remember that if I take the radius to zero, it was x tilde that became the spatial coordinate effectively and x decoupled. Okay, so so the x's sort of go away in the limit, and the x tildes are the geometric coordinates, and what this says is they have a constant commutator. Okay, so that's sort of a simple way to think about what's going on here. And in fact, if I write, if I collect x and x tilde into a vector, and if I write the commutation relations like this, okay, turning on a B field, it just corresponds to rotating the value of this omega. Okay, so the B field corresponds to an ODD transformation. I'll call that G sub B. And what happens can be thought of as simply conjugating omega by that transformation. Okay, so that's what I meant by covariance. Okay, and given that, you know, given that simple way of transforming, one can obtain a much more geometric picture of these general string symmetries. Yeah. Well. Okay. So on the space of x and x tilde, it looks like, oh crap, I don't remember. It's like this, I guess. So delta AB, DAB, delta AB, that sort of form. Okay, so finally, let me just finish up with one more comment, which is that, you know, I've sort of, t-duality here has played a central role, but I didn't really use much of its power. What I'm referring to is the fact that t-duality is not just a property of the spectrum of the theory. Remember, that's sort of how, one of the ways I introduced it was a symmetry of the constraint equations, okay? But in fact, in closed string theory, it's supposed to be a real symmetry. In other words, it's a symmetry of the interactions of the theory as well. Okay, and, or in general, this ODD is a discrete version of it, is a symmetry of the interactions. Okay, or, if you like, it's a property of the theory, not just at G string equal to zero, but for finite perturbative G string as well. And what you can show, and I won't go into the details, but sort of the simplest notion of an interaction is the Pants diagram, which you think about as weighted by, did that backwards? It's weighted by G string. Okay. And what you can show is that in fact, with this commutator, okay, so what happened here? This commutator led to this notion of a symplectic form on the zero modes. Okay. That's a geometric object, and it turns out that if you look at the effects of that quantity on the string interaction, then you can write a formula for, you can sort of think about this Pants diagram as corresponding to a product of two open strings, giving you another open string. Okay? And it turns out that there's a unique specification for what that product of strings is, okay, consistent with all of the stuff that I said here. And it's unique in the sense that the pair of Pants itself is invariant under t-duality. Okay, and what happens is that associated with the string interaction, there's a sort of pi flux, if you like, of this, of what I called a little omega over there. Okay, so there's a, if you like, if you just include a phase, which is just a Z2 phase in this case, and associate it with that vertex, then it is covariant with respect to t-duality. Okay? And so this is the claim is that if you take this into account, then the theory really is manifestly invariant under t-duality. Okay. Now, if you went back and you tried to make a statement like this using those co-cycle fudge factors, I think it's a nightmare. It's never actually been proven. It's just sort of a, it's a statement that all the smart people make, but it's not been, I don't think it's been really nailed down. Here it's nailed down. It's precise. Okay, so let me think. I think I had some conclusions. Well, okay, so some of the conclusions I've already said. Another claim that you might make is that, well, the real, if we now claim we understand what this string product is, you might think that that implies that we now have the proper formulation that might lead to a string field theory for closed strings. Okay, let me just leave that as an open question. Okay. The other comment, I guess, is that in this more standard implementation of non-commutativity, that's usually thought of as something that occurs actually in the open string sector. Okay, it has to do with D-brains and the fact that, you know, you get one way to realize these things is in sort of in terms of matrices that you think of as corresponding to the Chan pattern factors or the open strings ending on D-brains. Okay, and I've shown you that, you know, that sort of sits in a natural place with respect to the new non-commutativity that we found here. And so I think that, I don't understand this yet, but I think what's going to happen is that there's going to be a D-brain story that fits into this discussion as well. If you like, more technically, there's a discussion in terms of boundary states that you can give, presumably, and there's some sort of covariance property that encodes all of that non-commutativity. Okay, so let me end there. I think that's essentially all I wanted to say.
Can you say the T-duality, you made a comment that T-duality was, what is the exact relation between T-duality and the ODD sense?
Okay, so ODD is, you know, obviously it's a large group. The T-duality that I was mostly talking about is actually just a Z2 subgroup of this. What I'm referring to here is a more elaborate element of ODD. That corresponds to turning on the B field.
Is the whole ODD supposed to be a Zach symmetry, or is it just
or a discrete subgroup of it?
Or a discrete subgroup of that?
Well, okay, so there's a, you know, I didn't emphasize this, but I'm in a compactification, right? So if I do this in many dimensions, there's a lattice. Okay, people call the Neurine lattice. Okay, and so there's a subgroup of this continuous group that preserves that lattice, and that certainly is a symmetry. Okay, so that's what he was calling ODDZ. Call it ODD lambda, if you like, if lambda's the lattice.
So it seems that this set of the others, whenever you have some non-trivial periodicity condition, does this happen even for the case of a Navier-Schwarz fermion?
The real answer is we haven't really looked at fermions yet. That's a little bit different, right? Because maybe it's not different. I mean, that of course does affect the commutation, you know, the canonical commutators. It's very similar. It's very similar. But this doesn't, you know, none of this requires supersymmetry, okay? But certainly you could bring supersymmetry into the game, and that would be interesting. Gabriel?
So you were setting the symplectic structure on the word sheet.
Yep.
And normally, I would think one studies structure on the second quantized theory. So is there any relation between that symplectic structure and presumably some symplectic structure in the string theory?
You mean in an effective field theory language, or in the string field theory sort
in,
of?
In string field theory.
Okay.
You haven't really discussed what the fields are.
Yeah, I went over this very quickly. I mean, if you want to talk about this afterwards, I can tell you more about, you know, what I meant by this. And the answer to your question is essentially yes. This pi flux that I'm talking about actually comes from it comes from this symplectic structure here. So the world sheet symplectic structure is, we claim, tied up uniquely with the interactions in the string field.
Maybe you didn't say that the fields live now in a non-commutative space. They are
legal. Yeah. So that's, again, I didn't go into the details of that.
Yeah. So I was just wondering if there's a dual background you could turn on like this B field that would give you non-commutative in the original variables instead.
In the X's?
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean it would it's not part of the usual description, but you know, of modes of the string. But yeah, I mean you want to say that this is sort of a dual B field. Right. Mm-hmm. And yeah, that should be there. Definitely.
You know what it is, or?
Well, I mean I can at this level I can just do it by choosing a different G here.
Yeah, this is what people call usually non-geometric background.
Yeah.
It's a Poisson structure.
Two-fold.
Do you think that usually what happens is that people look at the symmetry, it's not really the way you wrote, but the GB has the property that X is not onto X, so it's unchanged.
Right, yeah.
So usually what people used to call backgrounds are anything that changes the structure of XT, but it doesn't change at all the structure of space, right? And so because they didn't know how to rotate the X, so all the B-field appears of rotation of XT gets modified locally by X, right? But what you call space-time has been unchanged, and in fact, every discussion in string theory just avoids touching space-time. Space-time is sacred. Whereas now, well, if X is still on the same ground, you can start to go back. And of course, really, there's nothing separate about it from that perspective. What really matters is the phase space function.
Yes.
But clearly, this is where the line was drawn. Never touch X.
What's the implication for effective field theory?
Yeah.
Well, so yeah. I'm trying to be nice. I don't know. So what is effective field theory anyway?
I mean, you started by saying that in string theory, this capital X plays the dual role.
Yeah.
Sigma model field.
Right. So you notice that part of that story is that you've made a decision on what you call space-time, right? What quantities here label space-time. Okay. And that's a perfectly reasonable, the way that we normally think about that, it's a perfectly reasonable choice from the point of view of non-compact space-time. X really is the coordinate in non-compact space-time. One of the messages here is that string theory compactified, well, there is no real good choice of what the space-time coordinates are, right? It's really a matter of what questions you ask of the string theory, right? So in some limits, well, it's a good idea to think of X as the coordinate, but in other limits, it's a good idea to think of X tilde as the limit. The way that Laurent was just discussing it is that if you sort of view a picture of this space of X and X tilde, this is actually a non-commutative space now. And what you mean by the ordinary classical notion of space is some sort of Lagrangian subspace of this. But there's no good choice. You could have chosen that, or you could have chosen that, or this choice is where it's still vertical, but the X tildes are sort of slanted in a sense. That looks like a background. It looks like you turned on a background. Well, in order to formulate effective field theory, I have to say, first of all, what I mean by space-time. This is not a notion that's going to be invariant under T-duality, right? Okay, so that's the first comment. The other comment is that, of course, effective field theory is some truncation of the theory, right? If you're thinking in terms of a compactification, right? One of the messages here was that string theory never really dimensionally reduces, right? Because of the winding mode. So it's not like a field theory. Okay. Well, okay. So normally the way that we think about effective field theory and string theory is we try to construct some limit where there's a low energy subsector that just talks amongst themselves, right? Okay, so now you know, alpha prime itself, though, is playing the role of the non-commutative scale in the phase space, in this phase space sense, in the space of x and x tilde. So, you know, so what's the message? Well, if you think about effective field theory as, you know, part of the limit you take is effectively you take alpha prime to zero, right? 1 over alpha prime is like the gap in the string spectrum. You know, you want to isolate on low energy modes. Well, this indicates that taking alpha prime to zero is subtle because it's, you know, it's implicated in the commutation relation.
So, is the derivative expansion in, you know, gravity?
In the non-compact case, yes. That's my answer. Is it clear?
I'm trying to I can always choose. I mean, like, this is like quantum mechanics. I choose a polarization, right? I choose some. I get. So what's wrong with making a choice?
Well, okay. So it's, so you notice that making a choice, or rather, the effective field theory limit. If you think about, you know, the alpha prime setting the gap, and you think about the effective field theory as limit is taking alpha prime to zero, that's analogous to taking h bar to zero, right? So it's analogous to taking a classical limit of this theory. So, you know, I think you really should think about what we're describing here as a sort of quantum theory, and the things that we're familiar with effective field theories are really sort of semi-classical or semi-classical limits. I think that's pretty deep from the point of view of, you know, how you think about quantum gravity, for example.
Another answer to that is that in a relativistic theory, there's nothing wrong with taking your frame of reference where time is your absolute time. But, you know, in the context where, you know, gravity is going on and it's dynamical, it might be a good idea to remember that, in fact, you know, there are different possible choices of reference frame, and they are connected, and in fact, the dynamical field, the gravitational field itself is the one that kind of changed this notion of time. So here, the analogy is really a strict analogy. If you replace, you know, the dichotomy between space and time as the dichotomy between space-time and dual space. Okay. So the picture is that this absolute reference frame of space-time now has to be, we call it relative locality. The notion of locality that you use, it's fine, but you have to remember it's a relative notion that depends on, you know, the matter content of different observer. And if you don't remember that, there are certain processes or problems in quantum gravity that you will never be able to really resolve, or you would at the price. It's like you could do the certain calculation of relativity, forgetting that there is time deviation, it's taking, it becomes completely cumbersome and sometimes almost impossible to break through. So this is really there's nothing wrong, but it's as wrong as doing relativity in a fixed reference.
And what would be needed if the momentum space was, what would have had to have happened for there to be yet another extra term in the symplectic one form that evolves dx, dx, switch, dx, twiddle? And you got this extra dp, dp, twiddle.
Are you, you're looking at this?
Yeah.
Well, okay, so this is the result.
Somehow when you carefully took account of the fact that the target space was compact,
yep.
Got that extra thing, and it would be at the target.
Can you get a non-trivial p commutation?
You must look up
p with p is not zero.
Oh, p with p tilde, not zero.
Yeah. Where would you tend to get that?
Oh, you know.
It seems a little funny that one is restored symmetry with x and x twiddle.
Oh, I see. Yeah, that's. Okay, that's a good point. So, yeah, there really is a difference here between the p's and the x's, right? That's
Is it that if the space-time was discrete and compact?
Yes.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
That's
then everything would be everything would be discrete. That's right.
Yeah.
That's right. Yeah. In fact, that's something that we were chatting about at some point. But that's right. So the reason that there's sort of a difference between the P's and the X's is that the X's are continuous and the P's are not. That's right. And it's good that the P's, P and P tilde commute, because that means that we can simultaneously diagonalize them and label the states by their eigenvalues. But you can't do that in the XX tilde variables. Okay?
Yeah, well, thanks for all again.